Bears Robert Crane, a Microsoft Office 365 MVP who knows practically everything there is about Office 365. He does stand-up events talking about Office 365. He writes about Office 365 on his blog site, and he does in-person training sessions and training videos about Office 365. There's also me, Mark Keane. I'm the voiceover guy and producer of this podcast. I'm also a Microsoft Azure technical specialist, PowerShell extraordinaire, and IT consultant, helping people move to the Microsoft cloud and consume it by helping them to make sense of it. This is a Need to Know podcast with Robert Crane and Mark Keane. It's all about the Microsoft cloud.
Welcome along to another Need to Know podcast. My name is Robert Crane, and I'm joined by my co-host, Mark Keane. Mark, welcome.
Hello, Rob. How are you?
Not too bad. Not too bad. I hear that you've been busy out there in the traps of late doing a lot of work around Azure.
Very, very, very busy. I have been doing Azure workshops. I've been half working for Microsoft. It's the cloud investment funds, which they've been doing just recently. Do you know much about the cloud investment funds?
I heard a bit about it, so why don't you tell us about it while we're on this topic?
So the cloud investment funds are a bucket of money from Azure. People who have bought Azure, as in Azure licensing and things, especially for the enterprise customers. They also know that the people that have bought the enterprise licensing, those people that haven't used it or haven't consumed Azure yet, they get a bit worried because they think that, okay, if people aren't consuming, they've bought it but they're not consuming, eventually spend's going to go down because they're not going to spend in the future if they're not consuming. So they want to help people consume it after they've bought it. And because Azure's like, just, it's changed rapidly, it's changed massively as well. So it's come at a good time, and I've just been traveling the country and doing Azure workshops and meeting with our partners and sort of getting them up to speed with Azure and giving them the new tools that they need to really start consuming.
So typical Azure workshop, what's that? That's involved. What does that involve?
Have you heard? Okay, so there's old Azure and there's new Azure. It's what I call it. There's old and new. I guess probably the best way to explain it, there's classic. So if you go into the Azure, the new portal, you'll probably see classic in brackets. And then the other part of it is Azure Resource Group or Azure Resource Manager. So there's two different types, and depending on where you deploy your stuff, it'll go, most of the time you'd want to put it in the new one, which is Azure Resource Manager. And so the workshops I've been doing have been sort of focusing on that and sort of getting people used to the methodology of the new Azure and giving them the tools like Visual Studio. And yes, we're both IT pros, and I don't know if you've got Visual Studio installed on your computer, Rob, but I never had it installed before this, and it's not as scary as one might think.
No, so when we're deploying the new Azure Resource Manager, is that basically sort of more coding than the original classic way? We've got to actually go in and use the JSON and the templates and all that sort of stuff. Is that, you know, sort of a difference?
Well, okay, so let me put it this way. When you install Visual Studio, you install what's called an Azure SDK, which is basically the Azure tooling within Visual Studio. You go in, there's still obviously a GUI in there. You can sort of connect to your account, your Azure account, enter your details in, and all of a sudden it springs to life and you see like a tree, a hierarchy tree of all Azure resources. And a resource could be a network interface card. It could be like a virtual machine. It could be a subnet. Everything's broken down into individual resources, and then you can actually deploy a new resource group which comprises of multiple different resources. And when you go through that motion, it automatically has gives you like a default template as such, like a JSON template, and you can easily, so you start off with something and you can easily read through that and you can make sense of it because it's obviously it's color-coded, it's in Visual Studio, and it's set out methodology. You've got parameters, variables and resources, and they all sort of, I mean, look, I worked it out, like it's not too difficult, it's fairly straightforward.
Yeah, I think the big advantage I see is that, again, we're moving to this world away from hardware into more coding. So even doing a configuration and deployment is coming down to basically deploying via some sort of coding. So I think, you know, again, the days of, I suppose, you know, running up a Hyper-V standalone machine and doing everything just manually one by one by one, fast declining. What we're seeing is the ability basically to use some sort of coding, automation, templates to be able to even deploy our infrastructure, which makes a lot of sense because it means it's easy to deploy, it's easy to debug. You can break up the templates. You have one for this, one for that. So certainly seems to be the way it's going, and something that, you know, the IT pro obviously needs to get their head around, because it's just so important, especially for Azure these days.
Well, the big thing, I guess, not okay. So you got the coding, and it does actually give you a default sort of template which you can build on. But I think over the top of all of that, you've got to sort of have an understanding, like, of the different design or design rules and methodology of, okay, the new Azure, you've got no cloud services anymore, which used to provide the endpoint, like the firewalls coming in, that doesn't exist anymore. So what is its replacement in the new Azure? It's network security groups. There's a load balancer, which is a separate thing altogether. You've got like a back-end address pool. So all of these different new terminology things, like, that people haven't heard of before, all of a sudden they've got to think, okay, I've got to design a application as such, like a business application, but that application will could comprise of multiple things, like a SQL database, could be a virtual machine, could be multiple things inside of this application. And then you've got to work out, okay, I'm going to deploy this as like an Azure resource group with multiple resources. And so you've got to think about the design of how you deploy your application, which is different to the current Azure. I guess it's good for me. It's I've sort of got my head around it. So now I can sort of keep going and helping with our partners. It's a good little revenue income.
Well, I think, again, it shows you the differences that, the speed at which Azure's moving, and also the direction. It makes a lot of sense. Mm. But again, I think my point is, it's moving to being, more DevOps, as they say. I mean, more programming, which means, you can't sit basically in the world of pure infrastructure anymore and just, add IP addresses to network cards or spin up virtual machines. It's, again, becoming a much more serious endeavor in the fact that you're going to have some understanding of things like Visual Studio, JSON, these resource manager. All this sort of stuff is becoming far more involved. I think it's easier, but obviously it's a very different world from what a lot of IT pros are used to. So again, they just need to invest the time to come up to speed, and you having invested that time obviously will reap the benefits of doing that, passing that information on. But again, you can see the direction that Azure's taking in that mm-hmm. respect of why it's doing it. And when you do, it makes a hell of a lot of sense and makes things so much easier, especially, obviously, the larger you get, the more critical it becomes to be able to do these sort of deployments, especially if you're doing them regularly. But, I mean, the Azure templates, if you need to spin up a network that has X amount of machines and they need to be this size and all these connectivity, you can basically do it in a template now. Mm. And I think that's what we're going to see, and that's going to give you a standard environment. So there are so many positives to it that people should be investing their time and getting up to speed with it.
So let's, all right, so just in closing for this subject, I will put a link, because it's not easy to install, I must admit. I'll put a link to Visual Studio. It's free. It's a community edition of Visual Studio. You'll install that, and it also installs the Azure SDK at the same time. It does take a while because it's got to download it. I think it's about a gig in size. But basically, kick it off, walk away, come back, and it'll be installed. It is free, and it does work. I'll put the link in the show notes.
Cool. All right. So some other news that I see around the traps basically is that Microsoft has released some guidance around not only the Windows 10 update information. There's a couple of links as to when they do updates to Windows 10, what those updates include, what patches they fix, and also the history. There's also now one for Office 365 desktop clients, so the Word, Excel, PowerPoint on the desktop. You can get version numbers and find out what's included in each version, because in the background, those things are basically updating on a very, very regular basis.
This is Office?
Yeah, this is Office, yep. So basically you can go into a link and you can see what version is the most current and the previous version, what it included and what it fixed. So for those IT pros that need to keep track of, the version history, Microsoft has made a page available to view that.
Yep.
I don't know if you've seen, Mark, have you seen that Dell was about to undergo a bit of a facelift and change its look and feel?
No, but I was just going to say just quickly, my Office is stuck. As in, when I go to update, it just doesn't want to update to the new version. It just sits there. And I know I've got two computers. My other computer's got a more recent sort of update version number, but my other Surface, every time I go to update, it just says no updates available. It's stuck on a certain version. I don't know if you've seen that before.
It could, again, there's a lot of factors in here depending what planet. Is it both from the same planet? Are they from the same SKU?
Yep. Both 2016. Yeah, it's just one's stuck and one keeps updating. I had it in the past, I remember, but then I had to uninstall it completely, flush it out, and then reinstall it all over again. It was a bit of a painful exercise.
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, those sort of things happen. There's probably an error somewhere in the event logs that might give you an indication as to why it's failing. Maybe there's a corrupt file holding it back. I think there's probably a registry setting or a re-registration that you can run that will sort of overcome that. So I think it is easy to fix, but worst case, as I said, is basically maybe uninstall. You could always try a repair, I suppose. That's the other option that you could try before you have to do an uninstall.
Okay, all right. Tell me about Delve.
So, Delve is basically the product that leverages machine learning within Office 365. It sits across all your information sources and basically gives you a single pane of glass across all the information sources that you and people in your business work with. So, rather than opening your email first and then go and look at some files and then trying to work out where something might be in OneDrive for business, you can use Delve to surface that information based on machine learning. Now, the way it was presented was typically you go into it, you'd see a list or a feed of files, and then you could go into your profile via another click, and then you could update your personal information, phone number, email address, bio, those sort of things. Now, Microsoft is changing the look and feel of Delve, so the features will remain the same, but it will move a lot of that profile stuff onto the front page, which I think makes a lot of sense. So what you'll see is, you know, your profile page displayed and information current about you and your contacts, but you'll also get the file cards, so that will let you know what your activity is and other people's activity. So they're moving more of the Delve information onto that very first front screen. I think that makes a lot of sense. Microsoft have a video showing you what that change will be, so that is rolling out as we speak now.
So this is like Big Brother is watching in a way.
It's not, because what it's doing is Well, the thing is, if you think about it, right, the idea is it's to make you more productive. So what we find with a lot of people is that most people generally work on a couple of files over, you know, a week or two, and then they get rid of those files, they work on other files. So if those files are buried in a structure, you know, maybe somewhere within SharePoint perhaps, or perhaps in OneDrive, rather than having to dig through that structure constantly, again, they will be surfaced as active files that you're using in Delve. Now, the big benefit, I think, of Delve is you can go in and look at your teammates and you can see what they've been working on as well. So what it's doing is looking at your interactions and then basically saying, look, you know, this is the stuff that others who you work with, what they're working on, and maybe you should have a look at it as well. So I think, again, human beings are very repetitive in what they do. They're very, do the same sort of thing all the time. So the machine learning is basically just sitting there and saying, you know what, this is what I see most commonly happening, and I'm going to put it in an ordered sequence that's going to make it easier for you to get to. So, again, if you haven't used Delve, I certainly highly recommend it. I think it's moving towards the way that the future of work is going to be. And the big thing is, once it's in Delve, again, if you want to search across all your information services, you just run a search in Delve and up it'll pop. So, again, we don't just work on one piece of information, we work on multiple pieces of information, and bringing those together in a single pane of glass is what Delve is all about.
I must say, I've been using it to stalk other co-workers. I've just been typing their names in and I say, okay, this person's working on this, this person's working on this. And I thought, oh, okay. But in the reverse of that, obviously people can see what I'm working on as well, which is, I don't know whether that's scary or not, but it could be used from a boss to say, oh, you haven't been working on this. What have you been doing or whatever? But although the positive part of it is too, is it makes people more tangible as to what they're working on. So you probably less have to worry about the bosses wondering what you're doing, whether you're slacking off if you're working from home. At least you've got like a bit of a history there, and they can say, oh yeah, such and such is working on this, and Yeah, no, that's probably.
Well, it doesn't say that you've spent, you know, 4 hours on this or whatever. It just basically surfaces the common document. So typically, what the issue is, if you're working on a project with a number of people, and a person who hasn't been on that project comes in, they can get a look across their new teammates, and they can see, you know, what are the most relevant documents. Maybe they work on the PowerPoint first. So again, I think that it just makes this sort of stuff more readily available. You're still working on it on a regular basis. It's all permissioned anyway, so if you haven't got access to it, won't see it in your Delve anyway, so there's nothing to worry about in that respect. It just, again, is another way of being able to give you access to the information, because it looks at information as what the interactions are between a team of people rather than you as an individual going in and out. When we think about it, there are so many instances where it is very handy to be able to see what other people are working on.
I agree.
I think the other huge thing that has been announced is the fact, finally, that SharePoint team sites have now been scaled up to a beginning space of 1 terabyte. So they used to be 10 gigs.
Wow.
They have now been scaled up to 1 terabyte.
That's massive. That might explain outages that I've been hearing in Azure maybe lately, because when they've been scaling up, possibly, I don't know. But yeah, that's good news. That's awesome.
Oh, it's huge. Yeah, that means that so many people wanting to use SharePoint or Team Sites as a replacement file server would struggle, because it simply didn't have the space to put a lot of their data. But now, like I said, the starting file size storage pool has been increased for all tenants immediately to 1 terabyte. So I had a look on my tenant. All my tenants now are 1 terabyte.
And it's automatically done?
Correct, it's automatically done, nothing for you to do, and that basically means now that all the team sites together can store a total of 1 terabyte. You also get an additional 0.5 gig for every licensed user, plus if you need any more than 1 terabyte, you can obviously go in and purchase that on a per gig basis. So I think this is a very big step, because it removes one of the major impediments to people moving more data, especially from file servers in a shared environment, into Office 365.
So does that mean, okay, so 1 terabyte, so I'm just thinking about like a customer who would have like a file share still on premises. And I guess that was one of the blocks, because they'd have to separate all their file server into different SharePoint document libraries. But now they can sort of focus on putting it all into one document library, could they? Well, then they've still got...
No, the issue was that most people had more than 10 gig in total. And the team site limit was effectively 10 gig.
And you had to break it up.
Well, you couldn't move it all up there, because, you know, the total pool size you had was a total of 10 gig. You couldn't put more than a total of 10 gig into SharePoint team sites overall. But now with 1 terabyte, it just removes that. And again, I mean, unfortunately, the majority of data I see out there is what I call cover my ass data, which means people really don't use it. They don't, they only need to refer to it, you know, occasionally, but they want to keep it, obviously. So, you know, not having enough space meant there had to be different options. And you tried to shoehorn stuff into a OneDrive for Business, which wasn't what it was designed for when it comes to working with teams. So again, just removes this impediment, makes it so much easier. And again, I think we're going to see more and more people moving to the Office 365 team sites, which is what it's designed for, now that it has so much more space, that make it easy to share documents and other information between a group of people.
So you can also have one document library now, if you can sort of fit it into 1 terabyte.
Yeah, if you want. I mean, that's effectively OneDrive for Business, which doesn't really make sense. But
okay.
I think basically, yeah, good design structure isn't replaced by the fact that you've got lots and lots of space.
Yeah.
But again, it means that, you know, what you can do is you can basically move just about any file server capacity that I have seen straight into in your team sites, whereas before you had to look at it and say, do you really need this? We'll have to leave this on-prem, we'll have to do this, we'll move this here. Mm-hmm. Now it's a case of, okay, everything goes into team sites. What structure do we want? Let's build it and let's move it. So, again, it makes a hell of a lot of sense. And think of it from an engineering point. You know, Microsoft basically flicked on a switch overnight and gave everybody 1 terabyte. I mean, that's no mean engineering feat when you think about it.
No. Okay, so what about file extensions? Characters and stuff. There is file character or file
There are some limits. I mean, they have been fixing those. I think there's only about 6 now that aren't supported. So typically the reason they have those is because in your HTTP request there are certain reserved characters, percentage, question mark, those sort of characters are actually used by HTTP protocol for different reasons, and if files have those similar characters in their names, then obviously it's going to be a problem because the uploading through a browser gets confused and displaying in the browser gets confused. But Microsoft have worked very hard to limit that to a very small subset of characters now. And again, there are ways. PowerShell is a great way to go through and basically do a bulk rename, locate any ones that are a problem, and then just change that to another character. So typically what I would see is, you know, profit slash loss or something, and then you change the slash obviously to a dash, then you're good to go. So I don't think it's anything major. What would be nice is that if there was a client, or the sync client would actually do that for you automatically, would identify the invalid characters in file names and make the change automatically for you. But hopefully that won't be far away either.
All right, what else is there?
What else have I got here is that Microsoft just announced today some updates to the security in basically Office 365. So what I saw was very interesting in this was it's now going to start offering cloud app discovery to Office 365 users. So I'll just read out what it says here. So Office 365 cloud app discovery gives you the ability to understand which other cloud services your users are connected to. From the Office 365 admin portal, you can view a dashboard on network activity. For example, you can see where users are storing and collaborating on documents and how much data is being uploaded to apps or services outside of Office 365. So cloud app discovery used to be a feature of Azure AD Premium. So my gut feeling is, not having seen this as yet, just reading about it today, is that looks as though Office 365 is going to get a basic version of Cloud App Discovery, and they're probably going to enhance the one that comes with Azure AD Premium. So, in essence, that allows you to see which third-party cloud applications, maybe like Dropbox, that your users are using, and then identify whether that meets the corporate requirement. So, it's very common to see people, users, download the free Dropbox, put it on their system, and then start sharing corporate information through a consumer-based service. So Cloud App Discovery allows you to basically monitor that, and it's coming to Office 365, which I think is great.
So it's similar to what SCCM used to do with the inventory on premises for all the computers, but except it's running
again,
from the cloud.
It's basically like, I mean, think of it like a firewall that's able to sit there and monitor what users are, you know, especially cloud-based applications. So if you've got users who might be using OneDrive Consumer and you don't want them to do that, if you've got people using Dropbox, you've got people using Box, you know, some maybe unsupported or restricted, you know, cloud-based apps, because we all know how easy it is for people just to sign up to cloud-based apps and start using them. The organization can now identify that through the Office 365 portal. I'm not quite sure exactly how the service works, but I get a gut feeling you'll put in it, like the Azure Cloud App Discovery, you'll put a small client on the workstations and that will allow the discovery. But it's interesting, again, some of these that were premium features in Azure are beginning more and more to filter into standard Office 365. Maybe they haven't got the full set of features, but again, it shows you, I think, that Microsoft has obviously got a good base to work from, and it can now start enhancing the Office 365 product and then extending further the Azure and the Azure AD Premium. So another reason to be a subscriber, basically, to the service, because look at all these additional features that you're getting.
Okay, and just quickly, too, talking about storage and things before, Azure's coming out with cool storage shortly, but basically it's similar to like the AWS Glacier storage. So cool storage is a much needed welcome addition to Azure, because it didn't exist before, and a lot of the companies that are backing up their data to Azure using Azure Backup, it costs a lot of money. Like if you're backing up machines, you've got to keep snapshots for the past week or maybe a year in some cases. It's quite a lot of data. So cool storage is going to make that much, much easier for people to store long-term storage for regulation purposes.
So we'll pop all the information about this into the show notes for the episode, but I think that's probably enough for this point in time. We probably need to get into our podcast. Anything else from you, Mark?
That's pretty much it at this stage. Yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, again, we'll update you next podcast on anything else we see out there. But again, look to the show notes for the details and the links to this information. And I think with that, let's get into our podcast. I'm joined again with a regular voice, Jeff Alexander from Microsoft. Welcome along, Jeff.
Hey, Robert. How's it going, mate?
Not too bad. Back again. What's been happening in the Microsoft world since we spoke? Obviously, Windows 10 is now charging along, and Azure and Office 365 still on the upbeat. I think it must be very positive news from inside Microsoft these days.
Yeah, look, Ian, funny enough, yeah, we did last year, you and I talked about Windows 10 quite a bit on, I think we did about two or three sessions on that. And look, I've been around the country a couple of times talking to customers about Windows 10. As you know, the November update came out, which was build 1511 of Windows 10, which added a few things, changed a few things. One of the best things, and I know we didn't have this on our agenda, but we had one of the things that it does is Passport for Work in build 1511. And we're actively using that internally at Microsoft. And how it relates to this is that I just built a Surface Pro 4 device and I have not joined it to the domain. Essentially what I've done is Azure AD, federated to Microsoft's on-premises solution, and then I can use our VPN solution to do Passport for Work. So when I connect into the office, if I have to do a VPN, I just put a pin in, or I use my face, whichever. And I'm not joined to the main, but I can still see all my resources. I can get to my servers, I can remote desktop to everything, I can get to internal tools, but it's a lot more lightweight because it's not getting hit by all those config manager policies and all that kind of stuff. So good for some users, particularly me who does a lot of demos, wants to have a machine as clean as possible. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, I noticed they've, like I said, they've just brought out in beta anyway, the enterprise roaming, profile roaming in Azure, so beginning to see more and more of those traditional on-premises style services that were connected to AD being moved to or offered with Azure AD. So again, I think also too I saw that the new Azure Connect client basic you can change the synchronization from 3 hours down to a minimum of about 3 minutes or something, I think, from memory. So it just shows you that that it's in place. The other big thing for me was they announced yesterday was that the default SharePoint storage space for team sites has been up from 10 gig to 1 terabyte. So I reckon that's going to be a huge impetus for people to start getting into the team site side of things, Office 365, because that had been a major stumbling block for many businesses because they only got 10 gig, I suppose, to put their data into. So it's all positive from what I see on my side, so it's great.
And you did an ebook on Skype for Business, which I pimped the other day. So that was
I just finished another book. Yeah, get it out. I don't know how many people actually read books anymore, but it's out there as a reference material. And the main reason is what I find is a lot of people still haven't started using some of these services that they're paying for in Office 365. So they buy a suite, they start using the email. For whatever reason, they never get to anything else, and it's like, well, as we're using now with Skype for Business, you can save a bunch load of emails, be far more in contact with people, do meetings, do all sorts of things, and it's all included free. There's no additional cost, so you really should be using it. So that's the idea with those sort of books, is just to give people that, okay, just read this, this will get you started, this will get you into using the product, and then I think you'll find life will be pretty much a huge improvement once you start using what you're already paying for. So that's the thinking.
Yeah, and look, I think it was last couple of days, Microsoft Press announced an updated, and I blogged about this the other day, is there's a new Windows 10 book for IT professionals that's based on the November update of Windows 10. So Ed Bott, who did a preview book of that, he writes a lot of Microsoft Press books. Previously, it was in preview and you had to pay for it, but now it's this one, the updated one, which is based on the November update, which has some of the new enterprise features in it, is free download in PDF. So I linked that to my, if you go to my blog, which is blogs.technet.com / Jeffa36, I did a blog post on this that has a link to the PDF. So if any of your listeners out there are actively involved in Windows 10, they should check out this free book. Because it covers all that new stuff with Windows 10, and that's the one we see customers deploying, is that November update. That's where we actually see customers starting their deployments.
It's very interesting because I've, like I said, I've updated my all the family PCs to Windows 10. You know, they were running typically running Windows 8, but now they're all on Windows 10. All seamless, all easy, no issues. They've all gone without any drama. You know, and I'm really impressed in a couple of different machines. Obviously, it's gone down really well. Some of those machines have then got the November update. Had a few questions about, you know, things updating in the background, but it's all gone very seamless and all the applications have worked. And generally, the experience I have out in the field and working with people is, it's becoming, you know, pretty seamless out there. Of course, you still have the occasional issue, but I'm very, very impressed, obviously, with the way that Windows 10 has gone in for the majority of users, and also how the updates are relatively, you know, coming down pretty smoothly and updating, and it's good for everybody to keep these things up to date, have use of the latest features. And again, the biggest one for me is you know, I've got a family member who's a bit old school, likes things, you know, the way they are, and the things don't change. I was expecting a bit of resistance when it came to Windows 10, so they were going from Windows 7 to Windows 10. Not a peep. 100% no issues, could work everything, was happy with it, could do everything they wanted. So it's like, okay, that's a big plus in my books.
It is, you know, because, you know, you probably are in that situation where you've got a lot of end users that are, because in the small business space, they probably upgrade quicker than enterprises. And particularly family members, like what the latest numbers were, like 200 million people, over 200 million people have upgraded, and then we also have 22 million people in enterprise that have upgraded to Windows 10, which is significant for an operating system that's only 6 months old. So it means that we've gotten a few things right in regards to the way that we do the upgrades. The work that they did there was phenomenal, and it just works. Like you said, it's phenomenal, and you know, so I've kind of, Windows 10's kind of moving along, going really nicely, so I've kind of moved on into the server world.
Yeah, well, that's what we're here to talk about, I suppose, next thing. So, you know, again, I think obviously that's the big thing we want to focus on here is, you know, the Windows 10 side of it's rolled out pretty well, and now Microsoft's coming in with the second hit here with the Server 2016. So, you know, what can you tell us about that?
Well, Windows Server 2016 is obviously, the next major release of Windows Server that's coming. It's in technical preview 4 right now. And that's the one, that one has a couple of new things in it that enterprise customers are going to be, or, you know, anybody's going to be really interested in having a look at. And it's really, if I had to put it in a nutshell, it's really bringing cloud to your enterprise. And I know that sounds like a marketing term, right? But what it means is you've been doing a lot of stuff in Azure right now, and you see a lot of things in Azure. Is they're taking a lot of what they learned in Azure, and they started bringing that down into Server in Server 2012. Server 2012 R2 had a few more things, you know, things like network virtualization, all that kind of stuff, been brought down. This is accelerating in Windows Server 2016. And so that is really starting, this is kind of a turning point for us, when you think about what we're actually doing. So what do you want to talk about first? Virtualization?
Yeah, so let's focus on the stuff that people are familiar with. So most people these days will be running a server, and typically now they're running virtualized and they're running guest machines on top of that. So, you know, what sort of differences is the 2016 version going to bring to that environment for people?
Yeah, well, just to, you know, to kind of recap, there was a whole bunch of stuff we did in 2012, as you know, and I think we might have, I don't know if we've talked about it on one of those shows before. And it's astonishing how many things that are in 2012 that people didn't realize were in 2012. Things like scale, the ability to go up to 64 virtual CPUs, all that kind of stuff that we did, generation 2 VMs, all that kind of Hyper-V replica, shared VHDX, all that stuff that we added in there that a lot of people didn't realize were there. So 2012 was a big virtualization release for us, and Gartner put us into a leader, into the Magic Quadrant, and we've been in there for quite some time on the virtualization side of things. So Hyper-V used to get beat up a lot back in the day, 2008 from VMware, but that's not the case much these days. Hyper-V is seen as a very viable choice within businesses. So, but there's a couple of things that have actually emerged out of this move that we've seen a lot of organizations moving to virtualization. I'm sure you run into a lot of customers that have virtualized a lot of their infrastructure, right?
Yeah, and I mean, that's obviously the way they get the biggest bang for their buck. I mean, obviously, they're running hardware, which is pretty beefy, but now they need to run, you know, the domain controller, they need to run terminal service box and maybe something else. So, yeah, definitely very common.
And what we're seeing is a side thing has actually happened that we didn't expect, which is security threats. So, as you know, there's an increasing number of organizations that are being the victims of cybercrime. And why that's important in the Hyper-V space is that there's this emergent thing, there's this thing that's happened with a lot of organizations that have become, that have virtualized a lot of their infrastructure. Think about the traditional model. Who, if in an Active Directory environment, who's the person that has the most access to an AD environment?
It's obviously the administrator.
Enterprise admin, right? Well, you know what the person has the most access now in virtualized? And it's what we call a privileged fabric. The spread of virtualization has led to security implementations in that fabric and virtualization administrators now have the highest privileges inside organizations. They have higher access than domain administrators, higher access than the most trusted IT staff. That actually brings to it a security implication. As more or service people are getting attacked, think about it. If you have a domain controller that's virtualized, an admin can basically export that VM or copy it straight to another disk, to an external disk, and take it somewhere else and run it, right? That is something that's really happening. So in 2016, we're introducing this thing called shielded virtual machines. And this is something that's come from Azure, and essentially allows us to do strong separation between the fabric administrators and the workload administrations, essentially saying that the fabric administrator, the virtualization administrators, do not have access to those virtual machines. Now, that is a very, very different way of actually looking at it. I mean, there's a whole bunch of things you have to actually set up in order to do that. So the data and the state of the shielded virtual machines are protected against theft and tampering. So basically what that means is that if I went and copied that domain controller and that domain controller was a shielded virtual machine, I couldn't run that somewhere else because it's protected, it's encrypted, we can't run it somewhere else. So that's a big thing that they've done in 2016. And we got ready for this because we added, you know, in Windows 10, if you're running Hyper-V on your local machine, there's some new things in Hyper-V Manager where you can secure boot, you can enable UEFI. That was in preparation for shielded virtual machines, right? So we have to be able to have a way for us to enable BitLocker inside a machine and shield that. And essentially, in Windows Server 2016, there is a new role or feature that actually runs called the Host Guardian Service. And the Host Guardian Service is a service that runs in 2012 that basically does key protection for the fabric controller. And it's basically a server within your organization that has decryption keys to allow us to run that virtual machine. So the first building block that we had for that was Generation 2 VMs, which we added in 2012 to R2 and Windows 10. So that means that we can do secure boot, ensures that neither the UEFI nor the VM startups can be tampered with. So that was our starting block for that. And then the next step that we're adding in 2016 is what we call the Guarded Fabric. And that is the new Host Guardian Service. Now, this is probably all sounding to you like cloud, right? This is stuff that we have to do in Azure to make sure that our stuff, you know, one customer's data is not compromised and cannot see the other customer's data.
Okay, yeah, I see.
So a lot of this stuff is coming out of Azure into Windows Server. So because we know that, you know, customers aren't going to move to the cloud tomorrow. They're going to be running on-premises infrastructure for quite some time, right? They're going to be running this stuff for a while. So how do we make it so that they can take advantage of what cloud has to offer, but still run a lot of that stuff locally, right? So we build attestation into this, which you've probably heard in Windows 10. There's two types. There's hardware trusted attestation, which is based on a TPM. Okay, so we can now support a TPM on a Windows server. Okay, so this is a server that needs to have a TPM version 2. It's a new type of Hyper-V host. Funny enough, you can actually test this out on a Surface Pro 4 or a Surface Book with Windows 10.
Oh, okay.
Because what you can do is you can actually, say if you have a Surface Book, right? You have a Pro 4, don't you?
Or a Surface I've got Book a Pro 3, looking to get a Pro 4, yeah.
So if you get a Pro 4, that has a TPM 2.0. And it has UEFI 2.3.1. So that supports CPM, that supports when you add the Hyper-V role, that supports our shielded VMs. So essentially what you could do is you can spin up a VM and you can shield that VM on that particular device through TPM. The other thing that allows you to do is nested virtualization. So we're finally adding nested virtualization to Windows Server 2016.
Oh, interesting.
And if your users don't know what that is, that's basically, it's kind of like the Matrix.
Yeah.
It's a VM inside a VM, right? So there's, I'm not really sure what the use case of this is, but apparently that, you know, it's something VMware's been doing for a long time. We are doing nested virtualization, and you can test that out on. So basically what you can do, and we'll talk about NanoServer shortly, is you can spin up a VM on your Surface Book, your Surface Pro 4, and you can run nested virtualization, run a VM inside that VM. Because you have TPM 2.0, you have UEFI 2.3.0 that has that hardware-based trusted attestation to allow us to do a lot of that stuff.
Makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, and this is, you know, people ask why do they, you know, people often think, you know, we just throw features randomly, but there is actually quite a plan in place about what we're trying to do and where we're trying to go with a lot of this stuff. And we put a lot of things in place early on, and people go, why has that been added? But then later on, there's a reason why that was actually added. And there's a lot of reasons. So that shielded VM is protected. So in the end, what you have is a fabric administrator that has no access to the VM. They can't attach debuggers. They can't do any other kind of stuff to that device because security is becoming such a big thing inside organizations.
Exactly, yeah.
So, you know, and if you move, so that's the security side of things. And then with availability, and I kind of break this down into a couple of buckets, is we've added some cluster resiliency in the, so we have VM compute and storage resiliency, which a lot of that has been coming from the storage fabric in Azure, meaning that we can provide resiliency of transient fires for a non-responding node within a guest cluster, in a Hyper-V cluster. And so we can do some stuff around putting them in paused states and all this kind of stuff. And failover clustering also has node quarantine, so we can take an unhealthy node and quarantine it and make it so that it's no longer allowed to be in the cluster. So that's pretty cool. The other thing they've added is guest clustering with shared VHDX and the ability, I don't know if you've played around with shared VHDX, but it allows you to do online resize of shared VHDX files.
Yeah, I've heard about that.
So what it means is that if you shared VHDX is a lot of time used where you don't have shared storage. So what you essentially do is you create a guest cluster with a bunch of disks that are attached to that guest cluster, but they're shared across all those VMs so that you can set up a guest cluster pretty easily. And so what we can do now is we can actually do online resizing of those without having to reboot the machine. The other area that they focused on is memory management. You know, we added dynamic memory many, many years ago. Well, now what we have this thing called a new runtime resize, mm-hmm. meaning that we can increase or decrease both the minimum and the maximum RAM without having to do a reboot of the machine. So that was another availability thing that they've added, which is really good. That was a big request to be able to do that. Some other things, rolling cluster upgrades. As you know, a lot of your customers are probably on down-level versions of Windows Server.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any customers that have a 2012 R2 cluster
Not the top
running in their environment?
Probably not.
Anyway, if they do...
We can find people.
They do. What we can do is a rolling cluster upgrade, meaning that we can upgrade one node to Server 2016 and run in what we call mixed mode. So the cluster is running in what we call is in mixed mode until we upgrade all nodes in the cluster. And then what we do is we run a PowerShell command to update the cluster functional level. And then after that, we have the ability to update the VM version level because in Hyper-V console, you'll notice that it'll give you the version of the VM name. And so what you can do is if you have a bunch of VMs running in a 2012 R2 cluster, it's most likely that your VM version is version 5. This, you can run a PowerShell script to update that VM to version 7. which gives you additional features, you know, the Nest, the, you know, the shielded VMs and all that kind of stuff. But the good thing is that we can keep those clusters running and we don't have to actually upgrade them all at once. We can do them one node at a time and do it over time and do it in a, and stay in that mixed mode for quite some time. So that's pretty cool. You are aware of checkpoints, or yep. we used to call save states. Well, yep. we now support what we call production checkpoints.
Oh, okay.
This is freaking cool. This is default, and we don't use save state anymore. What we use is VSS, the volume snapshot service. So what we do is that we now are saying we have full support for point-in-time images of virtual machines in under key workloads. I'm not sure if they've announced the exact workloads of what they are, but they will probably do that as we go along. But production is the default. You can go to standard checkpoints if you want to, but we are now supporting... remember, we used to not say checkpoints are not to be used in production environments, but we can now do that. And there's no change to the user experience, and we support both Linux and Windows systems to create that checkpoint, which is really good. The other thing is PowerShell Direct, so meaning, and you'll love this because it means that you can bridge the boundary between a Hyper-V host and a guest VM, meaning that you can do an enter PS session from the host to connect to a VM running on the host, and all you got to do is put in the guest credentials. That was a big thing. I can't remember whether we added copy and paste from within a VM connection in 2012 R2 or whether it's a 2016 thing. But that was a really big thing, is that we can finally copy and paste between, you know, between a VM running on your machine and the host machine that you're running it on. Hyper-V Manager now has alternate credentials, which is good. So you can do a connect as, which I'm sure a lot of your listeners are probably very familiar with. And you can also connect via what we call Windows Remote Management out of Azure. Okay, so this means that we have this in preview right now on Azure. If you go to the new portal, there is a new preview under the marketplace under management called Server Management Remote. And essentially allows you to manage physical virtual machines or machines running in Azure without having to use Server Manager or any of that kind of stuff. And you basically, what it does is it uses a gateway, and you don't even have to set up the gateway on your machine. You just download this little bit of software, and it sets up the gateway for you. I did it the other day, and it took me like 5 minutes. It was just unbelievable, and I was able to connect to a VM running on my laptop running Server 2016 from Azure. And just be able to see things like processes running, reboot the server, see device manager, see all the stuff that an administrator wants to see on a box without having to get out of my browser, just go into Azure. It's pretty phenomenal. So that's that whole hybrid thing that they're trying to do. Another reason to start using Azure, guys. It's good. And so, you know, that's a really good thing. So play around with that. The other thing is, I might have talked to you a while back about REFS, which is our new file system we introduced in 2012. That file system was really around data availability. But it's now been upgraded so that it can take advantage of VHDX, accelerated VHDX operations. Now, I don't know if you've ever created a fixed disk in Hyper-V on an NTFS partition. Say you go and create a 50 disk. That can take a while, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah? It takes a long time.
Yep.
The other day I have a PowerShell script that I run that basically goes and creates, I can set it up to 1 to 10 fixed disks, 20 gig in size. It's just a script that goes and creates these disks on permission. Did it on an NTFS partition.
Right.
And I'm in the PowerShell ICE. And the little thing's going across, the progress bar is slowly going across as it creates the VHDX files on the NTFS partition. Did the same operation on a REFS partition, and it was instant. 10 disks, 20 gig in size, and went blah, 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 done. I'm talking seconds, like unbelievable. So we do instant fixed disk creation and instant disk merge operation. So if you have a practice, and this is why we're going to recommend people put their VM stores on a REFS partition because of the way it actually does it basically is online during subdirectory reconstruction, because NTFS is such an older file system. It wasn't really constructed to deal with files size that we're dealing with today. And so REFS has been written from the ground up. It has a lot of the NTFS stuff in it.
Right.
But it takes this to another level. It's phenomenal how fast it actually creates it. So it's pretty amazing.
Cool. All
right. So that's virtualization.
I think what really excites me is this concept of this nano server. So rather than getting bigger and bigger and bigger, which I know you can do, the Internet of Things is pretty enamored. I think I'm pretty keen on this, because to me it seems as though, you know, downsizing, making these things smaller and really keeping a really small footprint, we're going to see, you know, lots and lots of these nano deployments and, you know, these sort of things basically everywhere. So what's the word on the nano server technology in the 2016? What can you give us, what information can you give us about that?
Well, first of all, I'll start from what we've been hearing from customers in this area. And you've been hearing this probably many, many times. You manage servers. First thing we've been hearing is that reboots impact my business. Windows Server has typically been an operating system that has to reboot quite a lot, right?
Yep.
So if you look at, why do I have to reboot my machine when it's patching a component that I never use on my server? Well, interesting thing we've been telling customers is to not put the full GUI on their machines. That way you won't have a lot of components, but nobody does that because they're used to using the GUI, because they kind of came around when NT4 was in place. And they're used to the graphical user interface. Fair enough. We kind of did that ourselves. We moved people towards that, but we're moving to a different area now. The other thing we get feedback is that server images are just too big. You know, 5 gigabytes or whatever for a base image of Windows Server with all the GUI and all that. You know, transferring images because we're in a virtual world, trying to move them over.
Yep.
Storaging. Yep. Yep. You know, it costs too much infrastructure.
Yep.
Infrastructure requires too many resources. If I want to run a whole bunch of stuff, you know, we moved to virtualization and we got better density with VM, but you still have to have pretty honking devices to run virtual machines, right?
Yep.
You know, you have to allocate memory to them, blah, blah, blah. So what nano server is just enough components, right? So we said, I want just the components I need and nothing more. So nano server kind of was born out of the cloud. And if we look at the story so far, if we look at Windows NT, traditional model is we had Windows NT to Server 2003. We had the operating system, and we had some roles and features and some apps installed on top of that, right? Mm-hmm. Standard kind of way we did that. 2008, we introduced Server Core. People hated that because they were going, oh, crap, what's this? They'd get to they boot a machine that was running Server Core, and it was a command prompt. And they went, what do I do with this? I don't know how to do this, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we still had the full server option, but nobody really did Server Core because Server Core was too hard to manage.
Yeah, yeah.
So in Server 2012, we introduced Server Core. We added some new stuff to it, like PowerShell, blah, 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 all that kind of stuff. Then we introduced a minimal server interface in Server 2012 R2, which basically gives you a mixture of Server Manager and basically gives you Server Core, but you get a bit of a GUI to do stuff. And then a full GUI shell. So, but people still, in my, talking to people still put the full GUI on the machine. Right? But they don't necessarily, because if you look at this, and you can watch sessions that Jeffrey Snover does on this.
Yep.
GUIs are for clients.
Mm-hmm.
That's where we're going.
Mm-hmm.
So what Nano Server is, a complete deep refactoring born out of the cloud. It's, and Jeffrey Snover uses a very, very good analogy. Stop treating your servers as pets. Treat them as cattle.
Okay, yeah.
Right?
That's a good analogy.
It breaks down, get another one. Who gives a crap? Stop trying to figure out why the server is broken down. Just get another one. You think we do that in Azure? No way. Our minimum container for Azure is like 3,000 servers. Right. If server breaks, they don't try to fix it.
Yeah.
Get another one.
Yeah.
Right? So what Nano Server is, it's a headless 64-bit only deployment option for Windows Server. Okay? It's deep refactoring with cloud emphasis. It's Cloud Fabric. It does clustering storage. It does PaaS, V2, ASP.NET version 5. supports VMs and containers, both Hyper-V and Docker containers, right? So the where it's different from Server Core is that the roles and features themselves live outside of NanoServer. No binaries in the metadata, standalone packages installed just like apps. So if you want to put Hyper-V on it, you put Hyper-V package on it. The big thing is around servicing improvement, and we did some analysis around patches released in 2014. Important bulletins, full server, 26 important bulletins. Server Core, 23 bulletins. Nano Server, 9. Mm. Critical bulletins for full server, 23. 8 for Server Core, and 2 for Nano Server. Reboots required in that time frame, 11 for full server, 6 for Server Core, and 3 for Nano Server. They're pushing to get that down to 2. The big thing that you're going to be very interested in, and I know you like these kind of numbers, is the setup time, the disk footprint, and the VHD size. Setup time for full Server Core is 300 seconds. Mm-hmm. Okay? Nano Server is 40 seconds.
Yeah.
Have a guess what the disk footprint is for Nano Server.
Oh, I don't know. Probably under
400 megabytes.
Yeah, I guess under a gig.
400 megabytes. For Server Core, it's 4.84 gigabytes.
Yeah.
Right? The VHD size is 400 meg for Nano Server. The VHD for Server Core is 6.3 gigabytes. Right? So Nano Server is, and also Nano Server is not installed in the traditional option. And this is why, this is where we're going to disrupt the way that administrators are, and this is why we've been telling administrators to kind of know how to use PowerShell, all this kind of stuff. And they go, yeah, and whatever, nothing happens. It's not selected as an option during setup. It is right now in technical preview 4, it is a separate folder on the actual ISO file that you download. And we basically have PowerShell scripts that are already in there, and you run those PowerShell scripts to go through and create a Nano Server. It's located on the Windows Server Media. So it's a zero footprint model, the key roles that we have are Hyper-V. So this is going to be ideal for Hyper-V scenarios. It'll scale out file servers, clustering, full Windows driver support. Anti-malware is supported. So you know Windows Server now has anti-malware built in by default, just like Windows 10. So we have scripts. We have a script called new Nano Server image and convert Windows image.ps1 that are in that directory. They're already there. They're very easy. It took me about 2 minutes or so to actually look at the script and create a Nano Server. It was so easy that it was unbelievable. The packages that we have are Hyper-V, failover clustering, file server roles, Windows Defender, OEM drivers, and all you got to do is do DISM to add those packages to it. And away you go from there. Now, to remotely manage Nano Server, you can use the traditional tools like Server Manager. You can see all that stuff within Server Manager, Event Viewer, Server, File Registry Editor, Task Manager, all that kind of stuff to do that. You can also use Azure to do that remote management. You can do PowerShell remoting, so you can do Enter PS Session to get into it. PowerShell DSC. Hyper-V Manager can manage them as well. PowerShell Direct can be done to manage that. But I really think out of the stuff that's going on with Windows Server, this is the most disruptive thing, but I think it's kind of where we have to go to as we move towards a cloud, what do we call it, mobile-first, cloud-first kind of model that Microsoft's talking about right now or everybody's talking about right now. And we have to have an operating system that was not built in the 1990s. If you look at it from a architecture and the way it's designed. Now, when you first log into a Nano Server, you basically get a DOS prompt and you type in your username, your password, and bang, away you go. But you're not really meant to actually log into the box because that server is meant to be doing a particular thing. It's meant to be doing, it's a Hyper-V server. It's a file server. You're not meant to log on to the thing and poke your head around and have a look at things. You do that all remotely. So I encourage, if your listeners are very interested in this, the Nano Server technical preview 4 of Windows Server is actually available. And that has the the NanoServer components in that. If they also go to http aka.ms/nanoserver, that's where all the documentation is for NanoServer. There's a new NanoServer team blog now as well. And guess who's behind all the NanoServer stuff?
Yeah.
Jeffrey Snover, the guy that did all the PowerShell stuff.
Yep. Makes sense.
So he runs the NanoServer blog. There's a whole bunch of people behind that. So, you know, I think this is a big change to the way that sure, customers can deploy. And, you know, with Server 2016, when you actually do the setup, the default install is Server Core.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the GUI. And there's one important change that they did in Windows Server 2016, and I don't know if this is going to change at the time of release, is that in Server 2012 and 2012 R2, you could kind of just go and remove the GUI and switch between full Server Core and minimal shell and all that kind of stuff. All you had to do was reboot the server.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're back to the way it was with 2008. Once you actually install a server with Server Core, it's a Server Core box. If you want GUI, you have to rebuild the box from scratch.
Hmm. Okay.
So, interesting, isn't it? It's, we're kind of nudging, is nudging the right word? People in this direction, I guess you could say.
Yep.
I just think, they're really kind of, things are really changing, and you know, I encourage people to look at the documentation for NanoServer, look at the blog, follow what they're doing. Because it's a big change. It's a big change the way you actually look at managing your servers. So that's very important to have a look at that. So
okay.
I don't know if you have any questions on that, but it's pretty interesting stuff.
I think it is. I put all the links to the show notes, and people can go away and play with it. That's one of the things I'm most interested in. But out of that, I think one of the other big changes or big things that a lot of administrators are hearing and they're not understanding and they're getting confused is this concept around containers. Okay, so you know,
yeah,
we're abstracting, we've obviously abstracted from the hardware to do our virtualization, but do you want to sort of give us a bit of an idea or layman's administrator's version of what containers are and why they're so important going forward?
Yeah, I mean, obviously in Server 2016, we are going to support containers. So that is a new feature of containers. Sorry, of Windows Server 2016. And if you look at what containers are, containers is, the easiest way to explain it is if you're in front of your machine, right?
Mm-hmm.
Go to your C drive and have a look at the directory of your C drive, right? So if you go to this PC on Windows 10, mm-hmm. and you go to your OS disk, and you see all your files there, right?
Yep.
Right? You see, you know, you might see Windows program files, blah, blah, blah.
Yep.
Yeah. What containers is another version of that, right? That you can then put apps into, right? So when you go to a container and you do a DIR on a container, you mm-hmm. just see another copy of Windows. All right, so that's the simplest explanation. But if you look at it, the way that we actually did this before, and containers is a kind of a new concept. It really came out of Docker is really the company that kind of revolutionized this whole container thing. Is that containers is a new way to ship deploy, and it allows us to get higher consolidation ratios and better utilization. So when we went to virtualization with physical virtual, you know, We started off with physical servers and, you know, applications had a one-to-one relationship, right? And when we went to virtualization, we got, you know, 50% virtualization utilization rates on servers, right? But with containers, what we're seeing is basically allowing us to do better consolidation. And essentially what containers are in Windows Server is an isolated runtime environment. Okay, so essentially we have a container management stack within Windows. We have a host OS with container support. And essentially because in Hyper-V, what you do in Hyper-V is that if you have a machine and you install the hypervisor, you know, you install the Hyper-V role, mm-hmm. that small thin line of code, that Hyper-V part, that 130 megs sits between the operating system and the hardware, right? And that's your virtualization stack. And what ends up happening is that your host becomes a kind of special VM called a parent partition. Well, containers, and then you end up inside each of those virtual machines, is multiple kernels within each of those virtual machines, right?
Mm-hmm.
What you do with containers is we share the same kernel. Okay, so we're sharing the same kernel on the host OS, and we run containers with bins, with libraries, and all that kind of stuff on top of that.
Mm-hmm.
That's isolated. All right, so basically means that every application thinks it's running on its own system, but in fact, it's actually running in container.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's lightweight, that isolates per each application. So what it means is that we can get much, much more on a system than we could with virtualization, right? And so, so you end up with the server, you end up with a host OS with the container support, which is essentially Server 2016. You can add that containers as a feature. Then there's a container management stack, and then your apps run in isolated areas. But they share the same kernel across that as well. Right? And then what we do with Hyper-V is we're in technical preview 4 is we've added Hyper-V containers, allowing us to have containers running inside a VM. So mm-hmm. that gives us even more secure, higher levels of resource and security isolation for virtualization workloads. That's the differentiator that Microsoft adds to that, is that we have the ability to do Windows Server containers, Linux containers running on, we have the Windows Server containers, the Linux container, which runs on Docker, then container images, and you can just upload those, right? Mm-hmm. So when you look at it, we have basically an OS image, an operating system that gets put down on there. We have hardware virtualization, virtual machines, OS images, all that kind of stuff gets layered on top. And then we have containers that sit on top of that and host OS, and they share the kernel that's actually there from the host operating system.
Mm-hmm.
And away they go. It means we can get much higher density. And essentially, when you talk about a container, it's all done through PowerShell. Essentially, when you get a container OS, you basically get another copy of Windows. You get a /\, and you'll see a Windows directory.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like, it kind of gets like the, like I said, like it's like the Matrix a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But it allows us to be, and you know, it's far quicker, it's far more flexible, you know, and we get into this world of applications need to be available tomorrow. This allows us to spin up things much more quickly. So developers really love this stuff, and we have a very, very strong partnership with Docker, as you probably know. So we've so you basically can manage containers in Windows with Docker commands or with PowerShell commands, because Docker has a plug-in to Windows Server that allows you to actually do the, you can actually go to Docker and you can download the Docker commands onto your Windows system. So we have that strong partnership allowing client images to be able to manage using Docker. So if people are used to Docker, mm-hmm. they can use that. And we support Docker containers, obviously Docker containers on Azure as well.
Yep.
So, you know, when we think about virtualization, we think about where we're going with NanoServer, then you bring containers into the conversation. Holy crap, this is not the Microsoft that your father used to work at, right? This is a very different scenario that we've got going on. Microsoft is changing the way they look at this. So it's pretty, you know, and developers love it because containers are so modular, so easy to, and it also brings a lot of those DevOps processes into play with containers. So it's a big deal. And, you know, in the time we have, that probably doesn't explain containers completely. I will be doing a webinar, a series of webinars in, early March, and it'll be a 7-part series, and one of the topics is all about containers. So I'll have an opportunity to show those and show what they look like and all that kind of stuff so that people can kind of see. It's better visual when they actually see kind of how it's laid out.
Cool.
So it's pretty, pretty exciting stuff.
Yeah, there's a lot happening, I think. Yep.
Yeah, there is.
There's so much happening, and I think that's the big thing. And I think, again, what I see exciting as is it went for many years that the service were getting bigger and bigger and more services and more services and more services. And now that we're seeing that some of those services like email are being offloaded to the cloud, which means you can free up the server to do, you know, to be smaller, to be more agile, to do just the things that you need, and then connecting up together with, like I said, managing it through Azure in a single pane of glass, which, you know, connect Office 365 and Azure AD, and Again, it's a brand new world, and I think it's importantly a huge opportunity for the traditional IT reseller to make sure that they, you know, obviously take that advantage and skill up in those areas, because it is a major change. But they've got the base skill set there of, you know, TCP/IP and networking and all that sort of stuff that they've managed for years, and they've just got to do I think a little bit of reskilling to bring that to the fore and take advantage of it. But I think it's going to give huge amounts of flexibility to providing solutions for customers large and small. So I think, Jeff, that we probably need to look at rounding it off. So if you want to give us basically a bit of an overview or a bit of a summary of those topics, what people should do, where they should go, and then just let us know how people can get in contact with you and follow what you're doing if they've got any further questions or queries.
Yeah, sure. I mean, really, the first thing is to download the technical preview 4 of Windows Server 2016. That will basically give you all the documentation around. Once you download that off TechNet, and you'll get an email that'll give you all the documentation of where you can get information about NanoServer containers. There's container documentation up on MSDN. So if you go to msdn.microsoft.com/virtualization. The containers documentation is up there, and they will send you all the details in regards to what we're doing in the virtualization space. As I said, follow the Windows Server blogs, including, you know, the Windows Server team blog, and also the NanoServer blog, the Server Core blog. My blog, if people want to get in touch with me, is blogs. Actually, it's easier to get in touch with me if you just go to http://about.me/jeffa36, that's J-E-F-F-A 36. That has my blog, it has my Twitter, it has all my social media contacts there. You can do it all in the one place, and people can contact me that way.
Cool, excellent. All right, well, I thank Jeff very much for his time and the information. I'll make sure that those notes are in the details of this podcast when it goes live, so you can refer to all that. If people need to contact me, you can do so on the Twitter at DirectorCIA, but again, ship any questions through to me. Happy to forward them on to Jeff, or any results that you find. Love to hear what's going on with these sort of tools and the opportunities that you see. But I think with that, I'll call an end to another Need to Know podcast from CIA Ops. Thank you very much for listening.
You have been listening to the Need to Know podcast from CIA Ops. For training on using technologies like SharePoint Online or Office 365, visit www.ciaopsacademy.com. By purchasing from the selection available, you'll be directly supporting this podcast. To provide feedback on this episode, visit www.ciaops.com/contact. This podcast is voiced and produced by me, Mark Keane.